Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Lawrence Wechsler, whose latest book is Vermeer in Bosnia, a collection of essays gathered over the past 20-odd years. Earlier books include the highly acclaimed Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonder. These books are collections, most of them, correct?
Some are. This particular one is an attempt on my part to try to make sense of the last 20 years of my writing. People complain that I'm all over the map. I write about torture in Latin America, strange museums in L.A. You know, I write about music and art, but at the same time about what I call cultural comedies and political tragedies. And the thought generally is that I just kind of career from one to the other kind of wildly. And it's always been my feeling that there's actually a great relationship between all these pieces. And in some ways, this collection here is a real attempt to try and show that there is a consistency of a set of issues that I'm working on, even though some of them can be very funny and some of them are appallingly tragic and sad.
How many pieces did you have to work with to start with to hone down to this?
Oh, I mean, in terms of my career, I've had dozens and dozens and dozens, probably hundreds like that. This ends up being about 20. Some of them from the New Yorker and some from completely other places, Rolling Stone, Salon, The Forward, all kinds of weird places that these pieces have appeared.
Before we go into some of the pieces and your career as a writer, and also I want to talk about the upcoming election and your perception as a nonfiction writer, someone who writes about politics around the world, let's talk a little about Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonder, which focuses on something called the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles. What is this place?
Well, it is an actual place, for starters. One of my favorite things about this book is people thought I was making it up. But no, if you are on Venice Boulevard in Culver City, you will see a lube shop, a Thai restaurant, a carpet store, a real estate, the Museum of Jurassic Technology, an In-N-Out Burger, and you're going to go, what? And if, like me, you get curious, you can knock on the door, and usually it'll be closed. But if it happens to be open, it is an absolutely astonishing thing. It kind of looks like a 19th century Victorian natural history museum with, you know, glass cases and oak tables and so forth. And it's just filled with the most astonishing stuff you've ever seen, the most incredible stuff, the most unbelievable stuff. Unbelievable because, as it turns out, some of it is not entirely true. And yet, actually, it is kind of true. And in some cases, things that are most unbelievable turn out to be completely true. It's a place where there's a great deal of slippage. It seems like a postmodern hoot. It has human horns and horn dance and microscopic sculptures, all kinds of crazy things. You begin to realize what it really is a pre-modern museum. It's a throwback to the wonder cabinets of the 17th century, which are the fundament of all modern science and all modern museumship. And so it's a place where you are continually in a state of wondering. You kind of hover between wondering at the amazingness of the world and wondering whether any of this is true. And it throws you back onto first things. It's a great, great place. And if you haven't been there, you have no excuse because you're very close. You could just go down there for the day, and it's well worth it.
And when was the last time you were there?
When I go to L.A., which was a few days ago, I stay at the most prestigious address in Los Angeles. I stay in the trailer behind the museum. It is the creation largely of one person named David Wilson, who a few years ago even got a MacArthur for it, actually. But it is the case that when the book originally came out, several reviewers separately said that they didn't think it was true that I was making it. They thought that I was making it up. Somebody said it was a work of magic realist nonfiction. Several different reviewers said that they thought I was making it up, but then they called information in Los Angeles, and indeed the place exists. To which I just want to say, you don't think I would have had the wit to put a phone listing? I mean, I write a whole book. You don't think I had the wit to do that? But somehow the fact that it was in information in Los Angeles was good enough for them.
You do mention something here which ties into Vermeer in Bosnia and may tie in actually to a lot of your other work and what you're doing. That's that this museum brings out in people a sense of wonder. And ever since I was a little kid reading, 15, 14 years old, reading science fiction and fantasy, I've been searching for that sense of wonder. Most people search for it in fiction. It seems that you're looking for it in real life, and of course, in that regard, I'm thinking of your essay on Ed Weinberger, who is a source of wonder unto himself.
The thing that was interesting about the wonder cabinets of the 17th century is that everything was potential object wonder. That's where you originally had paintings, where you marveled at the technique of the painter, but they also had, you know, sketches of microbes and the microscope next to it, which was also a wonderful thing. And then they had rocks that were completely strange. The whole world was just pullulating with the possibility of Marvel. In those days, parenthetically, it had something to do with the discovery of America. I mean, all this weird stuff was coming over the transom in Europe. I mean, you know, purple parrot feathers. What the hell is that? You know, or sacrificial urns or moose antlers. So much so that if that was possible, what wasn't possible? There was this explosion of credulity. There's a great line, I think it's Gerald Manley Hopkins, who says that things happen every single day, hundreds of times, that if they happened but once, would be an object of utter astonishment to you. Everything that happens in the world is completely marvelous and strange, if you just stop for a second and look at it. The first book I wrote was a book about Robert Irwin, and the title was Seeing is Forgetting the Name of the Thing One Sees. What it is to look at something with such penetration that you don't even remember what it's called anymore and so forth. And it seems to me that, indeed, that is something that the nonfiction writers I love bring out in the world. And it's certainly been a touchstone for me. I mean, I find that even writing about torture victims in Latin America, what they went through, how they survived it all and so forth, is an object of astonishment and marvel. And indeed, everything else in the world conspires to deaden that feeling in people. I mean, if I have a vocation, if I have a place where I'm trying to plant my flag, it's to try and, as David Wilson does at the museum, to reinstill some wonder. And that, parenthetically, involves reinstilling a sense of doubt. How could this have happened? Can I believe my eyes? I mean, all those sorts of issues are in play, and fertilely so, I hope.
I wasn't going to get into the politics now, but that question I've been asking now, and I'm sure our audience has been asking it too, how could we the United States be in a position it's now in with an election between an utter failure running against a competent man, we assume, and mm-hmm. I think he certainly would be. How could the American public be so gulled? How can journalists be so gulled? What is going on here? I mean, it's a different kind of wonder.
Yeah. The book has not yet been written, but it would be a wonderful one that would listen carefully to what some Bush supporters are saying. I mean, not politicians, but just people, and try and figure out what exactly is going on. There's a passage in my book, Vermeer in Bosnia, where I talk about strange deformations of political culture in Serbia. And this was, you know, 10 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago. I describe brain damage. I describe a bug in the software, as it were. I, for example, had a conversation with a guy in a bar in Milosevic's hometown, the dictator's hometown. This was when the dictator was still there, Milosevic. He's now in The Hague, but in those days he was still in power. And this guy had complete contempt for Milosevic. He had been in Kosovo. He came from Kosovo, and he said that he had been there. And it's not true. The Kosovo Albanians were not beating up the Serbs there, which was ostensibly the cause for the whole nationalist upsurge. And then I asked him, what did you think when Milosevic came and said that they were? He said, oh, that was great. That was really great. I really like that. Then I asked, you know, what do you think of how Milosevic has handled it? Oh, he's a disaster. He's a complete disaster. And then I said, who are you going to vote for in the next election? And he said, Milosevic. Does that sound familiar at this point? When I say brain damage, it's kind of a few qualities. I mean, there's the inability, the failure to understand the law of contraries. So that, you know, if A is true and it contradicts B, then B cannot be true. They can't, A and B both can't be true together. And then secondly, a law of consequence, that if you've come to believe X, it has certain consequences, and you have to behave in Y fashion. And this was completely blown apart in Serbian culture. Now, in fairness to Serbian culture, these are people who lived under communist propaganda for 40 years. They are people who live in a war regime. They were people who were being told by the whole world that this war president, Milosevic, was suddenly a peace president after Dayton, including Clinton and people like that. I mean, you could understand how this had happened. There was a kind of totalizing media that had done this to them, and a world of fear. I at one point asked whether this is what a mind looks like after a war, or whether this is the kind of war that is a mind that's susceptible to a war project. Everything I'm saying, obviously, is completely relevant in terms of the body politic today. And I would say that two or three things seem to me to follow through. One of them is the way in which fear, if properly deployed and exacerbated by the ruling powers, and that includes the media, it just makes people crazy. And it creates these, what I also call, bugs in the software, you know. In the case of Serbia, you would constantly, and by the way, this was absolutely true of Croats too, and I mean, but you would have, you know, 30 seconds of pristine lucidity followed by a free fall through the abyss of howling madness followed by complete lucidity for the next 5 minutes, you know. particularly in that case, all you had to do was type in the word Srebrenica. It's like a computer. If you just typed in the word Srebrenica, you would get, which was the massacre that the Serbs took, you would get this blizzard, this pox of rationalization spraying across the screen of the person you're talking to. You know, what about Vietnam? What about NATO? They bombed us. And besides, you know, it was only a few dozen people who were killed in Srebrenica. And you said, no, it was more than that. They said, yeah, well, you said it was 8,000. They said, well, they all committed suicide. You make us look bad. You know, just completely insane notions. But again, it's very similar to the kind of thing that you hear now. You know, if you say, why did we invade Iraq? What about 9/11? You say, well, no, wait a second. You know, that had nothing to do with it. And it had been so ingrained in terms of the media, the totalizing media, and I think we don't have totalitarian media, but we do have a totalizing media, and the ineffectiveness of the opposition, which has certainly been the case here. I mean, the complete failure of the Democratic Party to serve its constitutional function, or not constitutional, but in any case, its governmental function as an opposition party. The inability of the American system to generate a politics in which you can have a choice, you know, that you could vote with a choice, you know, with everybody rushing to the middle trying to appeal that same 3% of undecided voters, and so you don't get any kind of really clear statement of things. Indeed, the media, which obviously here is literally totalizing in the sense that it's being narrower and narrower ownership of the media and so forth, and that the people who fund Democratic Party campaigns and Republican campaigns are largely the same people. I'm not at all somebody who believes that the Democrats and the Republicans in this election are the same. And for the record, I mean, I don't think one should support Ralph Nader. It's too important an election for that and so forth in places where it matters. I mean, I don't think it really matters here in California or in New York. You can do whatever you want with your voters. That's a foregone conclusion. But having said that, the hesitancy of the Democratic Party to articulate things is a huge problem. And it was not that dissimilar to what was going on in Serbia.
The part of those essays that got me was the girl who was equating the 8,000 dead with one kid who was...
Well, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
This is, again, in Vermeer and Bosnia. I have an essay called Aristotle in Belgrade. It was one of the essays. I mean, Vermeer and Bosnia has a whole bunch of other stuff in it, but the Balkan section focuses on this. And there's this one girl I'm talking to who's a completely sensible girl. I mean, she's totally sensible. She ruined her life. She'd been visiting her brothers here in California, and then had gotten homesick, and in 1989 went back to Yugoslavia, like, wrong choice, and was stuck there in Belgrade. And she hated Milosevic, and she hated being stuck there, and so forth and so on. But I asked her about Srebrenica, and she immediately, no, they did it to themselves, blah, blah, blah. And we had a long conversation. When I finally really had gotten her to see, I mean, no, I actually have been to the graves. I've seen it, you know, 8,000 killed. She suddenly says, yes, but, you know, I'll tell you a story, she says. There was a restaurant on a hill, and some bandits broke in at the beginning of the war, and they asked, who here is Serb? And one boy came forward, and they killed him. And they told everybody else, if they ever mentioned this, they'd come back and kill them, too. And I kind of was waiting for the rest of the story, and that was the story. And I said, you know, what's the deal? 8,000 and 1,000. She said, yeah, sure. But the point is, they stabbed him. And I said, yeah. And she said, don't you see? You know, those people who were killed in Srebrenica, they were machine guns, so they just died quickly. Sure, there were 8,000, but everybody only dies once. That poor boy was stabbed. How is that different from what we hear on... There's a beheading, which is, granted, quite terrible, but it completely mesmerizes us as opposed to, you know, these horrible campaigns where you think you're trying to kill some, quote, terrorists, and, you know, kill a bunch of school kids and so forth. I mean, those people are invisible, whereas the few Americans who get, I mean, for God's sakes, Jessica Lynch, you know, had her leg broken or something, you know, oh my God, her leg was broken, you know, and it's as a way of completely avoiding, occluding what everything else that's going on. It's a problem.
Eventually you walk away scratching your head. It doesn't make any sense, which reminds me of something that Robert Olin Butler said. I interviewed him, and that interview will air in the future. He said one of the difficulties in dealing with political thought or political ideas is that they're irrational. It doesn't matter what side you're coming from. They're coming from your gut. You can't convince someone about something if it's coming from your gut. And, of course, your gut can hold contradictory positions.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true, but I think it gets exacerbated when there's a failure of political discourse. And that has happened here. In other words, you really need to, on a passionate level, address people's passions. So when people said, but they blew up 9, you know, but 9/11 has changed everything, you really need to be able to say, well, why did 9/11 happen? You know, when you know, in terms of everything that the 9/11 Commission has said, and you really need to make a point of it and really stand up to it. And there's a kind of half-hearted effort to do it, but I felt a failure on the part of the political class, and certainly on the part of the journalistic class. I mean, a thing that happens with journalism is you have the kind of, there's two sides to it. So, in other words, you know, some people say that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with 9/11, but the president says that they did have something to do with 9/11. No, that's not how it is. The president is lying. You know, so you don't report both sides of it. You say the president again lied today. I mean, that's a factual statement on that particular thing. It has been established. They're established fact. But, you know, there's such fear, you know, of just kind of holding people to account that you don't get that sort of thing. Something happened in the New Yorker, which was terribly disturbing. I mean, I had quit the New Yorker 3 years ago to pursue different things in my career. But I had long conversations with Art Spiegelman near the beginning of the war.
Who quit also?
Well, he quit in a particular moment, and a moment that I would have had to quit for political reasons if I hadn't already, which is the notes and comment that ran in the New Yorker just before the war started, in effect said, and I think it voiced absolutely what the plurality of establishment media felt, which is, you know, there are good arguments for the war, there are good arguments against the war, but the war is about to happen, and if you're against it at this point, you're going to be irrelevant. I mean, that from the New Yorker at that point. And now, the New Yorker has a history of having been irrelevant but right. The whole New Yorker history in Vietnam, we were the first newspaper that came out against the war in Vietnam, and we were completely irrelevant. For years, we were completely irrelevant. We were losing advertising and everything because we were so irrelevant. You know, at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, there were two senators who voted against it. They were completely irrelevant, but they were right. And they're the ones who historically will be the heroes. You know, the Morris and was it Gruning from, or which, the Alaska senator and Wayne Morris. But journalists are so afraid, the establishment journalists, of losing their access, you know, for example, you know, and being seen as kooks and blah, 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 that they really value this thing about being relevant, being in the game, and so forth. I mean, that's a major thing with the establishment journalists. They have also been hugely spooked by a spectacularly successful Republican right-wing campaign to portray journalists as liberal, so they bend over backwards to be seen as not liberal, which I assure you the conservative reporters don't bend over backwards to be seen as not conservative. So you've got that problem. And then, as I say, you've got the problem of who is controlling. We have a free press for those who have a press. You know, another thing, by the way, which I think is worth mentioning is the problem of the length of the campaigns. At the end of the day, the great, dark, dirty secret of why campaigns are so expensive is, A, they are long, and, B, there's all this stuff on television. It's in television's interest not to raise the issue of why candidates should have to pay anything for television ads. It's a public resource, the airwaves. And yet, television stations, the corporations, make literally billions of dollars on this extended, stupid campaign, and the news side of the division is never willing to raise that question. I mean, why don't we do what England does? They have a 30-day campaign, and so, you know, for God's sakes, is this election never going to happen? I mean, it's been going on for years and years, and it just wears you. There's all kinds of mechanisms that are there to wear journalists down. I mean, it's a huge problem. And by the way, at the end of the day, also, you know, you write the other way, you don't last long as a journalist. I mean, you end up at The Nation and KPFA and so forth, which is a perfectly good thing, but it isn't going to affect the thinking of the person who says they're shooting our boys.
It's a problem. You're listening to an interview with Lawrence Wexler, whose collection is titled Vermeer in Bosnia. Let's move on a little bit to the side of this, which is the relationship of art and politics. Mm-hmm. Your grandfather was a composer in Germany who was forced to flee.
I have a piece in there. His name was Ernst Tuch, and he was a powerful force to contend with in Weimar Germany. And the joke among the emigres in Los Angeles, where he eventually settled, is about the two dachshunds that meet on the palisade in Santa Monica, and one dachshund says to the other, you know, it's true, here I'm a dachshund, but in the old country I was a Saint Bernard. And my grandfather was a Saint Bernard in the old country. I mean, he wasn't chopped liver here, but he was, anyway.
The art that he pursued, which mm-hmm. was more atonal music, was considered subversive. Mm-hmm. And that brings up the question of the relationship of non-representational art, or even art that seeks to do something different, like cubism, which in your essay on David Hockney is a great explanation of why cubism works and will get me to look at Picasso in a completely different way. But there is a relationship between politics and art in that sense. Mm-hmm. What is subversive about non-representational art? What is subversive about dissonance?
This is the second half of a lecture that I've been giving. The first half is based on my Vermeer in Bosnia essay, in which I suggest that Vermeer profoundly, in a really important way, kind of invented our sense of peace and breathed it out into the world at a time when the whole world was like Bosnia. And everybody in the audience loves that. When that piece came out, people just loved it. Everybody was Xeroxing it. It was in the New Yorker, you know, 5-6 years ago. And I had so many letters from people, can I use it in my class and so forth. But, of course, that's all wrong. Our sense of art has always been on the side of the angels, of being a force for humanity. In point of fact, through most of history, artists have been on the other side. And it's not for nothing that the head of the Bosnian Serbs was a poet. The number two guy was a Shakespeare scholar who loved Shakespeare and thought he was making the world safe for Shakespeare. His favorite play was Romeo and Juliet. He used to love talking about Romeo and Juliet as he bombed Sarajevo. And it's not for nothing that Hitler was a painter. He was first and foremost a painter. Before he's anything else, Hitler is a painter who knows how to paint a building that looks like a building, a village that looks like a village, a countryside that looks like a countryside. And he can't get his stuff shown because there's all that crap in the galleries. There's, you know, these faces that are green. There's all this art from Africa. There's all these psychotic paintings. There's this expressionist crap. There's this cubist crazy stuff. He loves Schubert. He loves Mozart. And what's all this terrible stuff that's in the concert halls? I've often wondered, I mean, in all seriousness, I'm a little bit exaggerating here, but whether Hitler hates Jews because they like modernist art or he hates modern art because Jews like it. I mean, there's some kind of knot there about cosmopolitanism and modernism and so forth. And fascism before it's anything else, and this includes the NEH today, fascism before it's anything else is an aesthetic revulsion against a kind of temper of the times. And so it's not so much the point there's something wrong with cubism or there's something subversive, but rather that it stands in as a figure for the dissolution of certain kinds of verities that people rely on. The reaction of reactionaries is against this forward movement or whatever of the dissolution of a building that looks like a building, a painting that looks like a painting, and so forth. I mean, it's very important to understand. I mean, the old story about the Auschwitz commander who would go home and would listen to Schubert. Not only listen, but would play Schubert on the piano and play it beautifully. What people want to say is he didn't understand Schubert. And I think that's simplistic. I mean, I think he really did love Schubert. And he imagined that he was making the world safe for Schubert by killing Jews, who were these vermin who were going to destroy, you know. It's interesting also in this context that, in the context of my grandfather, that before the Nazis went after anybody else, before they went after the mentally retarded, the homosexuals, the gypsies, the Jews, they went after the artists, which is why the artists were able to get out. My grandfather was out of there by 33, and with good reason. His entire livelihood had dried up. Walter Gieseking, the great pianist who had performed his piano concerto 50 times in the previous 2 years, suddenly stopped performing it because he was a loyal Nazi and so forth. The painters got out, and in many cases came to America.
Brecht and Weil got out.
Brecht and Weil. All those people. The shoemakers don't get out. The leather merchants don't get out. You know, people say, you know, it's interesting you write about politics and art, and you know, they're so different. They're not at all different. Art is political, and politics is an art. I mean, there was that great film, by the way, a little while back about Hitler called Max, in which it was about a 1919, this young soldier, devastated by the war, visits this Jewish gallery dealer in Munich. And the gallery dealer sees that he, on the one hand, is doing all this kind of schlock paintings of buildings and houses and trees and so forth, but that he clearly has a huge demon of passion inside of him, a kind of performance art. And he's trying to see if he can't figure out some way to get all that passion into his art. Of course, Adolf Hitler, this young private, goes this other direction and into a kind of performance art, which is what he was doing in Munich and all the way through Nuremberg.
Makes me wonder about the current government or the people behind it, but it's not necessarily clear-cut because Ann Coulter loves the Grateful Dead or Bill O'Reilly loves U2 or you know, one can imagine Karl Rove liking Max Ernst.
Yes. One thing you want to say is that this comes back to how we started this conversation. The wonder of the world is that people are incredibly complicated and should be cherished in that way. I mean, you even have to cherish Karl Rove for how weird and strange he is, although you don't want to have to vote for his candidates. And so one of the things that's a challenge is to find, you know, where wonder ends and responsibility begins, or where, you know, at what point you have to suspend your marvel and kind of take action.
How do you decide on writing a piece, not just Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonder, but a detailed profile, which is not a biography of someone like Roman Polanski or the most unusual character in all of Vermeer in Bosnia, a man named Jerzy Urban.
Urban, yeah.
Urban. When you, or Ed Weinberger, mm-hmm. who makes bizarre furniture. Is he still around making?
Yeah, absolutely. Polanski is obvious. Polanski is Polanski. Ed Weinberger is a man, a completely vivid, vital man in his 40s who one day can't get out of bed, because he has been felled by a sudden case of extreme Parkinsonism. He ends up in his crumpled, crushed, concertinaed life designing incredibly complex and convoluted furniture, which in some ways is an expression of his own situation. And Jerzy Orban, for his part, is this deliciously delectable, horrible, horrible character. He was the press spokesman for Jaruzelski's martial law regime. He was incredibly cynical. He was voluptuously despised by the Polish people and despised them as well. He emerges from martial law the richest man in the country, not because he cheated in any way. He didn't do any of these kind of double dealings. He, in fact, took the measure of the new democracy and created a kind of like a screw magazine and made a fortune doing that. I mean, at one point I say to him that he struck me as a Shakespearean character, like a cross between Richard III and Lear's Fool. And he said, are you kidding? I always thought it would be Harold Pinter who would tell my story. The point about all this is that I'm always looking for ways to get at issues, but not as abstract, free-floating symbols or sets of thoughts, but as they are incarnated in people. And as I said, I mean, there's certain kind of common issues all the way through here, themes of passion, of what it is to inhale a spore and that can happen with an artist, but it can happen with the whole body politic, you know, when solidarity takes off. What it is to try to repress that, what it is to resist the repression. Again, all that, the workings of grace, oddly enough, the problems of blockage. I love thinking about light. There's a whole set of themes that run all the way through this. Exile, wonder, but never in the abstract, always in particular things. It seemed to me that Orban was a wonderful optic into the situation of transition, that everybody else was telling you these wonderful, marvelous stories about how democracy has come, blah, 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 and communism is over, and it's all simple. No, it's actually very complicated when you make that transition. And it's all kinds of things that suffuse the society. In a certain sense, Orban is Fox News before Fox News. I mean, and it's a way of getting at, you know, the cynicism, the delicious cynicism. I think Bill O'Reilly would make an equally wonderful profile, actually, you know, just if you could really get at it, not just be about what a kind of jerk he is, but, you know, really get at what's going on there. It's really an interesting character. You know, when I wrote my book about torture in Latin America, I mean, I felt it was important for people to read about torture, but people don't want to read about torture. This was during the Reagan period. And so I was looking for a ship. I was trawling for a story that people would read. And in that case, I came up with two thrillers, two capers, two stories about torture victims who get even with their torturers. And they're real page-turners. You know, that's how you do that. In the case of something like the Orban thing, I hope it's just so weird that you keep on turning the pages out of just the... It's such a strange story.
Absolutely. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who kept saying he always thought Jaruzelski was kind of a hero. You know, it turns out in reading that piece that in a way he was trying to reform, but there was too much pressure to reform, and he actually did the dirty work of
Jaruzelski. I mean, I also say at one point that if Shakespeare were alive today, Jaruzelski would be the person he would tell the whole downfall of communism through that optic, because, you know, he was on the one hand trying to reform communism, but he was holding it up. He was trying to knock the building over while holding up the ceiling at the same time, you know, and arguably saved Poland from a horrendous massacre. Keep in mind, Brezhnev was still there. It could have gotten incredibly ugly. And I think history will see Jaruzelski as a complicated figure. And I certainly will think of Orban, who at one point seemed monstrous, as also an interesting character.
Do you enjoy finding the topic, writing your own piece, rather than being assigned something?
Oh, absolutely. And that's increasingly hopeless kind of position to take. I teach a course at NYU where I now run this institute called The Fiction of Nonfiction. I begin the course by telling my students, you know, there'll be 15 students, and I begin by saying, nothing in this class will be the slightest practical value to you. It's even worse than that. By the time I'm finished with you, this is all you're going to want to do, and it's over. I mean, the kind of writing I love and try to practice, which isn't just New Yorker writing, by the way. It was Norman Mailer and Gay Talese at Esquire.
Sure.
It was Hunter Thompson at Rolling Stone. It was Willie Morris's Harper's, you know, which is to say, writing that at first might seem to be about nothing in particular. It's not, you know, peg-driven. It's not niche-slotted. It's not attention squeeze. It's not sound bit. You know, it's writing that seems to be about nothing in particular, but you read it because of the sheer vitality of the writing, and about halfway through you realize it's about the most important thing in the world. And the other thing, which I write books, but what I really love is general interest magazine culture. I mean, I love the idea that you're reading something about something you had no idea you'd be interested in, Jerzy Orban, and come Friday evening you're at some dinner party and three or four other people are reading it too. You know, I love that. And that is less and less the case. Everything is kind of Pavlovian at this point. It's a jolt, salivate, spend. You know, it's all designed to get you to spend money because there's a hand in your back pocket. I mean, when I quit The New Yorker, I did it on condition that I could start my own magazine, and I am trying to start one at NYU called Omnivore, and we'll see whether it gets anywhere. But it's precisely to get past this kind of neo-Pavlovian situation which kind of runs our culture today, both art and politics.
There's very little room in that sense for the long short story, or in your case, where I think you're coming from, is the essay.
But it's not just the length. It has to do
with the
eccentricity of the content and the eccentricity of the mode of address and the notion that one's voice matters, you know, that not everything is homogenized into a single kind of voice. That used to be a lot more common, and all kinds of things begin to fall away when that falls away. I'm somebody, for example, who very much believes in an I voice in my writing, not out of megalomania, but on the contrary, out of modesty. It kind of says that, you know, there's no way of knowing exactly what happened. This is my attempt to say, you know, and I'm not being hegemonic about this. I'm just saying this is one person's view doing the best he can at this moment, you know. And when you don't have that I voice, it's kind of the institutional authority of X, Y, or Z, and I mean, I find that a problem. And you get these hilarious things where you get, he said to a reporter, well, wait a second, there's him and there's you, and there was a reporter there too? I mean, there's all this kind of weird, but all that is designed to make it sound like it's truer than it would be if you just said he said to me.
These pieces in Vermeer and Bosnia are older pieces. What have you been working on lately? What's the last three or four pieces you worked on?
I've been doing a series of pieces for McSweeney's, which I call convergence pieces, and I'm in fact right now I'm in town partly editing that. That my next book will be coming out in a few months, or I guess in half a year, called Everything That Rises, a giant book of convergences. And my convergence pieces where I take two or three images that you wouldn't ordinarily think of side by side, often images, sometimes poems, sometimes, and kind of the rhyme between the images is the occasion for the piece, but the poem, as it were, is the essay I write about that. So just to give you one example, one day I was walking down the street, this is about 10 years ago, and there was the cover of Time had Milosevic on it, and the cover of Newsweek had Newt Gingrich, and they looked exactly the same. And I suddenly realized that their politics were exactly the same. I mean, in the sense of the opportunists who kind of become true believers, you know, and so forth. And I wrote a piece called Pillsbury Doughboy Messiahs, comparing their careers, you know. But, I mean, I will do that with works of art. I do it with photographs that appear in the newspaper and kind of odd connections, so there's that. I'm then going to be doing, for the last 25 years, I've been writing about two artists, Robert Irwin and David Hockney. Whenever I write about one of them, the other one calls me and tells me I got it all wrong. And so I've got 25 years of this argument between the two of them going on through me. They never talk to each other. And so I'm going to be bringing out one book, which would be 25 years of writing about David Hockney, and one book, which would be 25 years about writing about Robert Irwin. They'll be in a match set, and you can kind of let the argument play out among yourselves. I'm running this institute at NYU these days and trying to get my own magazine started, so I'm not doing that much of my own writing.
How do you feel about The New Yorker today, and how did Remnick take the fact that you guys all walked?
I'm regularly being asked to come back, and I'm not saying I never will. At this point, I'm trying to start my own magazine, so I'm doing what I'm doing. I think, honestly, that Remnick, he's not a neurotic, he's not a crazy, he's not completely nuts to work for like it was under Tina. I respect him, and I think he's doing an honest job of doing a magazine that he thinks is the way it should be. It doesn't happen to be the magazine that I'm interested in. I mean, I was telling somebody that he's the best editor the Washington Post has ever had. But it's not the Washington Post. It's very newsy. There isn't much room for idiosyncratic voice. It's kind of full-bore ahead political in a kind of a centrist establishmentarian way. It's just not in itself evil. I mean, and there's often very important articles that appear. But the place for the eccentric and the odd and so forth and for the extended essay isn't there as much as it used to be. In fairness to Remnick, parenthetically, he's saddled with the circulation that Tina Brown built up. We know how many people will read an odd piece about surfing, let's say, and that's 425,000. 425,000 people used to subscribe to The New Yorker year in, year out. You didn't have to go after them. You didn't have to send them letter after letter. They just renewed. It had the highest renewal rate in the world. Tina punched the circulation up to 850,000. In doing that, she lost about 200,000 of the original, which was part of the idea, that she hoped that the advertising would make up for it. But you can't do the kinds of articles in a magazine for 850,000 that you did in the other magazine, and so he's somewhat trapped by that.
You've been listening to an interview with Lawrence Wexler, whose most recent book is Vermeer in Bosnia. I'm Richard Wolinski on Cover to Cover.